Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Phil Dierking and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, for hundreds of years, women in Myanmar's Kaya area have worn bronze rings around their necks. The rings are a traditional symbol of beauty. They also extend the necks of the women, making them very long. But now, younger Kayan women are turning away from the tradition of their ancestors. Mutu is one of the few women who knows how to make the traditional rings and put them on. She is 48 years old. She says, "The shorter sets are easier to make. Everyone has their own preference. So if someone doesn't like what you've put on, you have to take it off and start over." Maria Kane has been wearing rings on her neck, wrists, and knees since she was 8 years old. She is now 83. She said, "My dad told me I looked like a boy. He said, 'So I will buy you a gun to hunt as a man.' But I said, 'Every girl is wearing the rings, so I want to wear the rings too.'" Maria never removes the rings, even when cooking, eating, or working. "It is comfortable. At first it was hard, but now it's fine. I eat and food goes down," she said. Wearing neck rings was once expected of all Kayan women, but more and more have stopped wearing them. Maria's granddaughter, 20-year-old Zau, is among those who have not kept with the tradition. "They're heavy and uncomfortable. Also, I don't know much about them. That's why I don't wear them," she said. The rings make the women's necks very long, but they also press down on the bones around the shoulders. Wearing the rings can also cause discomfort when swallowing. Even Mutu admits that safety is a concern. "If you don't make the rings correctly, someone can choke," she said. Experts say there are now fewer than 100 long-neck women in Myanmar. That is down from about 300 to 400 in the 1990s. Some people wonder, however, if tourists will still come to buy goods in Kaya when the long-necked women are gone.
A leading scientist says researchers in Florida are close to developing a way to control the algae known to cause deadly red tide. Michael Crosby heads the Moat Marine Laboratory in Sarasota, Florida, a leading research organization. A 10-month-old red tide has been killing ocean life along Florida's southwestern coast. Huge numbers of dead fish have washed up on beaches from the city of Naples up to Tampa. Red tide can cause problems for humans, too. Contact with the algae can cause breathing difficulties, burning eyes, and skin pain. On Monday, Governor Rick Scott ordered emergency measures to deal with the crisis. Crosby said he welcomed the move, which releases more money and resources to solve the problem. The Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission suspects the red tide caused the deaths and strandings of hundreds of sea turtles this year. The agency also blames it for at least some of the 68 deaths of manatees. Crosby said scientists are currently testing a process that would pump red algae-filled seawater through an ozone treatment system. Then, the purified water would be pumped back into the ocean or waterway. Crosby said the experiments were carried out in huge 25,000-gallon tanks. He said all succeeded in removing the poisonous algae. Crosby said the water chemistry returned to normal within 24 hours. Scientists also are studying the use of seaweed, parasitic algae, and other organisms to fight the red tide. Red tides happen almost yearly in Florida. They start in the Gulf of Mexico, where microscopic algae cells called Karenia brevis feed on deep sea nutrients. Ocean currents carry the algae close to the coast. The current Gulf Coast Florida bloom is the worst in more than 10 years. It began last October and has spread across more than 80 kilometers of coastline. I'm Phil Dierking.
Cajun culture is celebrated in areas along America's Gulf Coast, the southern coastline that borders the Gulf of Mexico. Most of the Cajun population lives in the state of Louisiana. The Cajuns' ancestors were French-speaking colonists who came to the southern United States from an area that is now part of Canada. The Cajuns brought with them different parts of their culture, including music, dance, and food. Cajun food is known for its many different spices, combined with mixtures of seafood, meat, and rice. One of the most common ingredients is crawfish, a small freshwater animal mostly found in rivers or small bodies of water. Crawfish can be cooked alone or put in a traditional Cajun soup called gumbo. Now, a different kind of Cajun food is gaining popularity, Viet Cajun. This style of cooking was created by the area's Vietnamese immigrants. One restaurant specializing in this kind of food is Crawfish and Noodles in Houston, Texas. Trong Nguyen is the restaurant's owner and head cook. He explains what makes his Cajun boiled crawfish special.
We sprinkle that with the Cajun seasoning right now.
The mixture combines traditional Vietnamese flavors with common Cajun spices and ingredients. He says he thinks he developed a good sense of flavors from his grandmother. Nguyen was 17 when he settled in Houston in the late 1980s as a Vietnamese refugee seeking political asylum. In the United States, he studied and worked several kinds of jobs. But in 2008, he decided to open his own restaurant to specialize in Vietnamese Cajun food. He says many other immigrants along the Gulf Coast also turned to the seafood industry. They created new Viet Cajun dishes using crawfish, shrimp, and even alligator. While Vietnamese and Cajun cultures might seem different, they do share some elements from French influences. The Cajuns were French colonists, and Vietnam is a former French colony. Nguyen also uses a lot of French ingredients in his food and says other Vietnamese cooks also understand this connection. Nguyen says he hopes the next generation of cooks will keep working to create even better versions of Viet Cajun food to unite the two cultures even more. I'm Brian Lin.
Participants in Girls on Rock get to explore forests, hike mountains, and sleep under the stars. But that is only part of the experience the young women seek in the free Colorado-based educational program. The program also provides them the chance to carry out field research with actual scientists. Girls on Rock is part of the organization Inspiring Girls Expeditions. The group supports similar programs in the American states of Alaska and Washington, and in the countries of Canada and Switzerland. In late July, a team of 9 girls and 5 instructors launched the first Girls on Rock trip. The group spent 12 days in the Gore Mountains near Frisco, Colorado. Each girl took turns climbing a wall of rock. After climbing, the girls took a hike. During the hike, they stopped for a lesson on map reading. They also learned how to find their position on Earth using nothing but a thin rope and information about their current elevation. The young women had several reasons for wanting to enter the program. They wanted to meet new people, be involved in science during the summer break, and face fears. They were surprised by how quickly they made friends as they learned how to trust themselves and others. Girls on Rock does not consider academic performance when choosing participants. Instead, interested girls are asked to explain in writing why they want to participate in the program. The 9 girls came from all over the U.S. Miyawa Sochil Haski, who goes by the name Mia, is a 16-year-old from New Mexico. She hopes to study at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in the future. Guadalupe Ramirez came from the city of Denver, Colorado. Small towns were also represented by students like 16-year-old Chloe Crocker from Fredericksburg, Texas. Some brought outdoor experience with them, like 17-year-old Talia Emery Muhammad from Silver Spring, Maryland. She rock climbs as a sport during the school year. 18-year-old Jesse Figard from North Carolina said she had never hiked before. She has Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which in the past kept her from similar outdoor activities. "I've never been so dirty," Figard told the Associated Press. "This is the longest I've been without showering. It's refreshing." Evelyn Cheng, an ecologist, and Megan Blanchard, a chemical ecologist, began developing the program in 2014. They were both studying at the University of Colorado, Boulder. The two scientists asked for donations, applied for grants, and requested help from companies to establish the program. Now they are seeking corporate sponsorship to keep the program going. Blanchard said she felt she was given many opportunities and wants to give that to others. Science and rock climbing are both majority male fields. And Cheng said women can sometimes feel like they do not belong in those fields as a result. She believes Girls on Rock can help make that change. If I had something like this early on, I would have tried so many more things, questioned so much, Cheng said. I'm Pete Musto.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We conclude the story of the 37th President of the United States, Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon's first term ended with the hope for a complete American withdrawal from the war in Vietnam. Yet Americans were still angry about the war and its economic effects on life at home. Inflation and unemployment were both high. Some political observers thought Nixon would not win a second term. Nixon, however, was sure the American people would support him. He did not actively campaign in the state primary elections leading up to the Republican nominating convention. He focused much of his attention on foreign policy, including his historic trip to China in February 1972. In May, he traveled to Austria, the Soviet Union, Iran, and Poland. In Moscow, he signed the first Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, or SALT, with the Soviets. But back in Washington, something happened. It was a small incident, but one that would have a huge effect. On June 17, 1972, five men wearing surgical gloves broke into the headquarters of the Democratic Party. The Democratic National Committee offices were located in one of the buildings in a complex called Watergate. Police caught the burglars, and at the time, the incident did not seem very important. But the men carried papers that linked them to top officials in the Nixon White House. The question was, did the president know what was going on? Nixon denied any wrongdoing. In time, the Watergate break-in would lead to a congressional investigation. But in the summer of 1972, attention focused on the presidential nominating conventions. Democrats met in Miami Beach, Florida, and chose George McGovern, a senator from South Dakota, as their candidate for president. The Republicans also met in Miami Beach and, as expected, nominated Richard Nixon for a second term. McGovern, a liberal, attacked Nixon for his policies on Vietnam. However, Nixon easily won the 1972 election. He defeated McGovern, carrying 49 of the 50 states. But the shadow of Watergate would not go away. Two young reporters for the Washington Post, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, had been following the story since the break-in. In early 1973, they found evidence that linked the break-in to White House officials. The evidence also showed that these officials tried to use government agencies to hide the connection. The burglars had been financed with money connected to the committee to re-elect the president. Pressure grew for a full investigation. In April, President Nixon ordered the Justice Department to carry it out. Attorney General Elliot Richardson appointed law professor Archibald Cox as a special prosecutor to lead the investigation.
The committee will come to Alma.
In May, a special Senate committee began its own investigation. A former White House lawyer, John Dean, provided the major evidence.
It is my honest belief that while the president was involved, that he did not realize or appreciate at any time the implications of his involvement. And I think that when the facts come out, I hope the president is forgiven.
By July, the public learned that President Nixon had made tape recordings of some of his discussions and telephone calls. The Senate committee asked him for some of the tapes. Nixon refused. He said, "The President of the United States has a constitutional right to keep such records private." A federal judge, John Sirica, ordered the president to surrender the tapes. Lawyers for the president took the case to the Supreme Court. The High Court supported Sirica's decision. After that, pressure increased for Nixon to cooperate. In October, he offered to provide written transcripts of parts of the recordings. Archibald Cox, the special prosecutor, rejected the offer. So Nixon ordered Attorney General Richardson to dismiss him. Richardson, the nation's top law enforcement officer, refused. Instead, he resigned, as did his deputy, William Ruckelshaus, when Nixon ordered him to fire Cox.
The Watergate drama has taken a half year to unfold. The president's unique actions in firing two popular and respected members of the executive branch and forcing a third to quit took less than 8 hours. The impact of all this, clearly colossal and yet to be measured.
Jerry Lande reporting for ABC News. The incident happened on a Saturday night and became known as the Saturday Night Massacre. Nixon then had Acting Attorney General Robert Bork dismiss Cox, and the president eliminated the office of special prosecutor. He gave the Justice Department the responsibility of continuing the investigation. President Nixon had another political problem in addition to Watergate. In late 1973, his vice president, Spiro Agnew, was forced to resign. A court had found Agnew guilty of violating tax laws. President Nixon asked Gerald Ford to become the new vice president. Ford was a longtime member of Congress from Michigan. By that time, some members of Congress were talking about trying to remove Nixon from office. Was the president covering up important evidence in the Watergate case? Was he, in fact, guilty of crimes? In April 1974, Nixon surrendered some of the recordings of conversations in his office. However, three important ones were missing. The Nixon administration tried to explain, saying the tape machine had failed to record two of those conversations. The third recording, it said, had been erased accidentally. This became known as the famous 18-minute gap. Many Americans did not believe these explanations. 2 months later, the Supreme Court ruled that a president cannot hold back evidence in a criminal case. It said there is no presidential right of privacy in such a case. Congress moved ahead with efforts to bring charges against the president.
Congress now has no alternative but to institute impeachment proceedings.
In July 1974, a committee in the House of Representatives proposed to impeach Nixon, that is, put the president on trial in the Senate. If Nixon were found guilty of crimes connected to the Watergate case, he would be removed from office. Finally, Nixon surrendered the last of the documents sought by congressional investigators. These documents appeared to provide proof that the president had ordered a cover-up of evidence in the Watergate burglary. Every president promises to protect and defend the Constitution. The congressional investigation showed that Nixon had repeatedly misused government agencies in an effort to hide wrongdoing and punish his critics. The hearings also showed that he had tried to block the investigation. On August 8, 1974, Richard Nixon spoke to the nation. His long struggle to remain in office was over.
Throughout the long and difficult period of Watergate, I have felt it was my duty to persevere, to make every possible effort to complete the term of office to which you elected me. In the past few days, however, it has become evident to me that I no longer have a strong enough political base in the Congress to justify continuing that effort. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
By resigning, Nixon avoided impeachment and possible imprisonment. Never before had an American president resigned. On August 9th, Nixon's vice president, Gerald Ford, was sworn in as the nation's 38th president. Soon after becoming president, Gerald Ford made a surprise announcement.
I deeply believe in equal justice for all Americans, whatever their station or former station. But it is not the ultimate fate of Richard Nixon that most concerns me, though surely it deeply troubles every decent and every compassionate person. My concern is the immediate future of this great country.
He pardoned Richard Nixon. Many Americans criticized Ford for doing this, but the new president believed he had good reason. Ford wanted to deal with the other problems facing the nation. He did not want Watergate to go on and on. But the investigation did go on. A number of officials in the Nixon administration went to prison. The effects of Watergate on public opinion and public policy would be felt for years to come. For example, Congress passed laws designed to prevent an administration from using its power to punish opponents. Nixon's abuses also led Congress to order government agencies to provide more information about their intelligence gathering activities. Nixon's actions violated the basic trust between the American public and their elected officials. It led to more aggressive reporting by a new generation of journalists hoping to follow in the footsteps of Woodward and Bernstein. Their coverage of Watergate won a Pulitzer Prize, one of journalism's top awards, and led to a movie based on their book, All the President's Men. It starred Robert Redford as Bob Woodward and Dustin Hoffman as Carl Bernstein. Jason Robards played Washington Post executive editor Ben Bradley.
You got more than one source.
Yes, sir. Yeah,
who are they?
Source.
Sloan. Sloan and who else?
And there's another guy, Justice, who so far won't confirm the names of the other two who control the fund that we're working on.
What deep throat.
He's not a source on this.
But do any of them have an axe?
No.
Personal?
No.
Political? Sexual? Is there anything at all on Mitchell?
No.
Can we use the names?
No.
When is somebody going to go on the record in this story?
You guys are about to write a story that says the former attorney general, the highest-ranking law enforcement officer in this country, is a crook. Just be sure you're right.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.